Hello, everyone. Dan Rodriguez here for another episode of Beyond Diet Podcast. In this episode, we're going to do a recast. We're actually going to do the very first replay of the very first episode. And next week, we'll be back on our regular schedule. So until then, please enjoy this. Thank you.
Hey, everybody, this is nutritionist Keith Klein, and I want to welcome you to this podcast. This is a really unique opportunity for you to access information that you're not going to be able to find anywhere else. And the reason that I tell you that is this particular podcast goes so far beyond diet that we will be talking about the human interaction with food, the emotional side, relapse prevention, and the psychology of eating management. It's so much more than that because it also involves various aspects of getting ready for a show, current studies that are being done, and how you're being manipulated and lied to by the media food chain. Beyond Diet is a really unique show that I'm so glad you're tuned into, and it's further really more unique because of my co-host, who's Dan Rodriguez. Dan has been in the business of marketing for a tremendous length of time, and he came up with a great idea. I wanted to introduce you because, one, this was your idea, and two, because you're going to really be the mediator for the people that are not able to call right away and ask us questions. And I think people need an introduction into why we're doing this together, and that's because really you serve a great purpose, which is to be able to ask the questions to a nutritionist that's at the top level of his field, and ask questions in the way that an average person would know to ask. So I want to welcome you to the show, Dan, as well as welcome everybody else. And why don't you give a little history of your background, and then I'll give a little history of mine.
Absolutely, Keith. Hi, my name is Dan Rodriguez, and I'm a co-host of Beyond Diet Podcast. Like Keith was saying, I wanted to create a podcast where you have someone like yourself, Keith, that's a nutritionist, and also an eating management expert. And my role for the show is to give the average Joe's input, to ask the questions that, you know, normal people would, and to clarify things. So I'm really excited. As far as with me, for years, just like most people, I wanted to find a way to lose weight and to look good, and to be fit. And I was just frustrated with the lack of information and the contradiction of information that's out there. And just the smallest detail makes a huge difference. So I'm just really excited. I'm excited that we're doing this, and I'm excited to share this information with the public, because I think it's about time.
Absolutely. Folks, if you're new to this podcast, which I'm sure you are, many of you may have heard of my name before in the world of fitness. I've been doing this for 30 years, and I'm going to be real brief because how do you summarize 30 years of work in just a matter of minutes? I've been a writer for Muscle Media. I've published over 200 articles on the subject of health, nutrition, and psychology in terms of eating management. I'm the CEO of the Institute of Eating Management in Houston, Texas, where I've resided for 30 years. And our practice, which is what we're bringing to the table in this podcast, revolves around the mixture and blend of psychology with nutrition along with motivational aspects. In our clinic, we don't only deal with eating management issues and obesity, but we also deal with professional athletes. My career spans working with several Olympic athletes who today hold Olympic gold medals. There's 9 young kids in the world today that came to see me who've never competed, which today are now professional bodybuilders. The last 10 years winners of the Miss Texas USA, 10 years in a row, are all our clients. So our experience between childhood obesity, regular nutrition, longevity, as well as clinical nutrition spans literally 3 decades. And so the work that we'll be bringing to you will commingle in all of those different areas. And rather than to continue to tell you more and more about myself, I've done radio in Houston for 13 years. I'm the local Health Beat reporter on Channel 2 News. And also I've written 5 books. But rather than get into all that stuff, I think it's more important, Dan, that we just jump right on in and get started with information that the people probably want to hear.
Well, first of all, Keith, let's talk about this podcast because this is our first episode. And I just want to make people aware of, you know, how frequently we'll be posting these episodes. This is going to be a weekly podcast, and we are going to make it approximately 45 minutes in length. I think let's get started with weight. What if I wanted to lose weight, Keith? What is it that I need to do? And what is weight loss?
Well, Dan, it's a multitude of things. And the problem, as I see it with Americans today, is they've been so brainwashed to get on a scale. And the scale is actually one of the worst measures to be solely using in an effort to change your body. Because when we hop up on the scale, it can fluctuate 1 to 4 or 5 pounds every single day. And I'm kind of fascinated by the fact that people will go to bed at night, jump out of bed, run to the scale, and get on it as if there's like this weight loss fairy, much like Santa Claus, that taps you on the head overnight and miraculously burns off 20 pounds as you slept. Rather than having people focus on a scale, at the Institute of Eating Management, none of our clients are ever allowed to weigh themselves. And there's a good reason for it.
Okay.
Well, the reason is that it feeds the compulsive tendencies that we want to cure. A person is not a product of their weight, but rather they are a product of their food choices, the decisions they make, and how much they exercise. So when people say, I want to lose weight, really what they want to lose is body fat. And at the same time, most people want to look more toned, and that means gaining additional lean body mass or muscle in the right places. So I think gone are the days when we have to focus so much on the scale weight, but rather look at how our clothes are fitting, how we feel, and not focusing so much on a scale weight.
You know, one of the things about weighing yourself, Keith, is, for example, if I get up in the morning and I weigh myself and I weigh, let's say, 185 pounds, and I get up the next day and I get on the scale and I weigh 182 pounds, you know, that weight is really going to determine how I feel for the day. So it really sets the tone, you know, for that day. So if you had a good day on, you know, if you've lost a couple of pounds, you're going to say, okay, well, I can, you know, I can cheat a little, or I've been doing really good. But one thing that I did learn is that you can't live on the scale. I mean, a scale is not intelligent. A scale cannot tell you how much body fat you've got. A scale cannot tell you how good you look. A scale cannot tell you how your clothes fit. So, you know, that's really, I mean, the way you look is determined by how much body fat you have. Don't you agree, Keith?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the reality is that the scale is one measure of what you're doing. But see, what it can't tell you is the fluctuation of how much food is retained in your body, how dehydrated or how hydrated you are. It can't tell you how much lean body mass you gained. So what we see in our clinical practice is time and time again where a person doesn't like the way they look. While we do use a scale in our clinic to weigh them, we rely more heavily on the body fat measurements, which can tell us precisely how much their fat is going down or up and how much their lean body mass is going up or down. And so most people don't have access to a body composition. But see, what I would like to do is get people away from the scale because it really holds them down like a heavy ball and chain. Because if, as you said, if you hop up on the scale and you see that it's down 2 pounds, you get so elated that you go out and celebrate. And you celebrate usually by eating more food. The very thing that should be motivating you just caused you to not lose more. If a person didn't lose weight on the scale, then they're frustrated all day and they needlessly then cut back more food, and that can then bite into their muscle. So what our real interest is not getting on a scale every day, because here's the real truth, Dan. A person's weight is not the issue. It never is, it never will be, it never has been. Their body weight or their body fat is a product or a byproduct, if you will, of their choices and decisions. So, Dan, let me ask you a question, and you just answer these to the fact of, is this true or not? Okay, do you understand that you're exactly where you are because of your own choices and decisions?
Yes.
Okay. But yet, let's say you don't want to be where you are. Well, then it has to become blatantly obvious to you that your weight is not the issue, but rather your weight is a result and a byproduct of the choices and decisions that you've been making. Is that accurate? Is that true? Okay, now listen to this. Then it must also become very clear to you that if you want to change your weight, you can't keep doing the same things you've been doing and expect anything to change. Where America has it all wrong is in the concept that this change to look better should be painful. It's always based on pain, deprivation, rigid omissions, and guidelines. And what you should notice is the name of my clinic is the Institute of Eating Management and Relapse Prevention Center. It's not the Institute of Pain, Deprivation, and Rigid Omission, right?
Right.
Okay, now listen to this, Dan. In all my years, 30 years of practice, clinical practice, sitting in front of so many different types of clients, I've come to realize that small changes over the course of time yield huge results. See, the dietetic community has sort of jammed down people's throats that they have to drop 10 pounds in a week, drop a dress size in a day.
Right.
And the reality is this. Nobody has to give up all the things they love to do. So, Dan, if you're eating red meat 3 times a week, and let's say that's part of your problem, or let's say you're eating Mexican food 3 times a week. See, I would never tell you you can't have the Mexican food, but rather I would ask you as part of the plan, how often do you feel you could reduce your Mexican food down to and still really like what you do? Because let's be clear that if one small change can yield dramatic results over time, what would happen if you went from eating Mexican food 3 times a week to only eating it once every 10 days or so?
Well, honestly, I mean, you can replace Mexican food with just about any, you know, food that you shouldn't be eating or indulging in. But, honestly, Keith, I think the real issue is that there is a lot of confusion out there. People don't know what to eat. They don't know how much to eat. And there's so much contradicting information that, you know, personally myself, if I didn't have the right information, I think I'd be doing something right. And it doesn't give me the results that I'm looking for.
Well, there's a ton of confusion because the media food chain brings us to that. But here's where we gain clarity, Dan. The thing I was just proposing to you, we don't want to overlook it, because what I'm essentially saying is that we have to construct something that the individual enjoys doing so much they know they can do the rest of their life. See, if you went from eating Mexican food 3 times a week down to once every 10 days, aren't you doing better?
Oh, absolutely.
See, Dan, the real way to go about in the process of change is to make that list and pick the one thing that you want to work on this week to change. And over the course of the next 2 weeks, once that change is in place, you then move to the next one. And you see, as the person gradually adjusts how often they were making these bad choices and decisions to better ones, the weight naturally comes off and that individual never has to feel as if they've been on a diet.
Again, Keith, I'm going back to, I think people are really confused out there because of so much contradiction. You've got people that say, well, okay, you got to eat a high protein diet and carbs are bad. And you've got someone else saying, well, don't eat protein, eat carbs, or all you got to do is watch your fats. And it's really confusing out there. And I think most people don't even have sense, don't even know what's good anymore because of all the books and all the information out there that's just plain old confusing, and they try it and it doesn't work.
Well, I think it is common sense though, Dan, but do you see what I just did? I was just giving you a very common sense approach, but see, in your brain, because you're a typical average individual, what you're doing is resisting the simplicity of the change by thinking, A, that it is complicated. And what I just did was put it in the most simplistic terms, that the process of change begins by writing down and focusing on the top 3, 4, or 5 things you think are holding you back from getting what you say you want, then looking at the list and asking yourself, which one of these would I like to work on first and make the change? Now, from there, then, we move into the educational process as you're talking about. See, but you have to first identify the roots of your problem, because if you don't, then you have nothing to change and you don't really know what to do. Now, the educational process begins next. So the first thing we do is identify that which is holding you back from getting what you say you want. Now, the next step, to answer your question, yeah, are we confused? Well, let me ask you this. If you were looking at a label, Dan, and you saw a can of regular soda, and it had 40 grams of sugar in it, as an average consumer, would you know how many teaspoons of sugar that is?
Actually, no, I wouldn't.
See, how on earth could you make a better bad choice, or how on earth could you go into the process of change if someone says to you, I want you to reduce the amount of fat you eat, I want you to sort of pull back on sugar, but notice I never said the words, I want you to give it up. I just simply said, I want you to adjust it. Now watch this. It's a very simple formula. Folks, when you look at a label and you see the grams of sugar, you simply divide it by 4 and that converts it into teaspoons. So on a can of regular soda, there's 40 grams of sugar. So 40 divided by 4 would be 10 packets of sugar in one 12-ounce can of Coke. I would challenge anybody to, it is, and I would challenge any of you to go to your cupboard right now, and let's be clear that most people who drink regular sodas don't drink one. Let's just say they drink 2 a day. That would be equivalent to drinking 20 packets of sugar a day. And I challenge you to now visually, here's what I would do in my clinic, Dan. I actually pull out 20 packets of sugar and lay it on the desk in front of them so they can see how much it really is. Now, here's what I was saying from the beginning. One small change begins yielding huge results over the course of time, only if that change is permanent and you know you can do it the rest of your life. Now, let's just assume that you are drinking 2 cans of Coke a day for 7 days. How many packets of sugar did you ingest in a week? 140. See, then I put 140 packets of sugar, which comes out to be 1.25 pounds of pure sugar. I lay that in front of the individual, so now they have the visual cue to go, oh my gosh, I had no idea. Now, but see, what I just gave you was the formula to begin change. If somebody wrote down on their list that I drink too many regular sodas or I eat too much sugar, now they have the ability to leave the table, go back home, and take a look at their labels and reduce their sugar, not give it up. Now, do you realize that if you simply were to switch from regular sodas to diet, and granted, people shiver and shake when you tell them that because they're addicted to it, your taste will acclimate and change to anything you do over time. So you see, anybody who drinks regular Cokes and switches to diet finds that when they go back to regular later, it's way too sweet. But here's what you essentially did. You eliminated 140 packets of sugar a week times 52 weeks in a year. And that one little change just now coupled with your reduction of Mexican food will begin yielding results in your weight.
I think of, you know, when you think of the word dieting, you know, I don't like the word dieting. I don't know about you. But when people think of, well, I got to get on a diet, they think of drastic changes to their diet. It means plain old food, you know, eat a carrot, you know, with a plain chicken breast. And it's that's really something that's discouraging, because you're thinking, oh, it's got to be an awful experience. But what you're saying, Keith, is if you make slight permanent, because the key here is permanent changes. If you make permanent changes, that will make a significant difference in the long run, right?
But that's true. Yeah, it's true of everything. This is a method called Kaizen, and I came across it 30 years ago and began integrating it into my clinical practice from a psychological vantage point. See, Dan, here's what it basically says. Small changes, when grouped together over the course of time, yield huge results in productivity, efficiency, finance, or whatever area of your life you want to apply it to. See, the concept has always been that nobody has to give up those things they love, but they certainly can't keep doing them as often as they used to and expect change. And you see, because we've had the dietetic community pounding it in our head that we have to write down everything we eat, that we have to kill ourselves through calorie deprivation, the only thing that people will get when they diet is a lot more problems, both psychologically and physiologically. They will get dramatic problems from dieting physiologically and psychologically. And let me share with you what I mean by that. Because, see, I think when people begin a diet, the first thing they do, Dan, is they give up all their favorite foods. Because that's what they think they're supposed to do. After about 2 weeks, I don't meet anybody who can do that more than 8 weeks. It's like there's a snapping point and suddenly people just got to have food, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Cravings for the food you haven't been allowed to eat. And then all of a sudden, when the cravings surface, because you've committed yourself to change, you're going to say, no, I can't have that. The conscious brain says no, but the subconscious brain sitting there saying, give me, give me, give me. Now, the moment you encounter a trigger, Dan, it's over. You know, and all of a sudden, a negative emotional state, frustration, anger, the IRS calls you, the stock market drops. The moment the negative emotional state strikes, which is the trigger, that's when the individual starts binging. And when they binge, what's left next is guilt, because they basically violated the very rules they set in place, which was, I'm not going to eat any bad foods at all. Now, when the guilt sets in, they're going to rationalize and justify by saying, well, hey, I've blown it. Now I might as well really blow it. So what the heck? And then off they go completely. Does that sound familiar?
Absolutely, Keith. I mean, I think, you know, once you blow a diet and you say, oh, my gosh, I blew the diet, you think the world is over. Now you basically keep going down that path. And it really, you know, you just want to continue doing that, and you don't want to pick up where you left off.
See, that's where it becomes illogical. See, through neuro-linguistic programming, which we'll explain later, neuro-linguistic programming is identifying each person's defective thought process. And once we can see the defective thought, we identify it for the patient, pull the defective thought out of their head by cramming in an effective one. So let me give you an example.
Yeah.
Imagine for a moment, Dan, that you're driving down the road and you get a flat tire. Would you ever jump out of your car and slit the other three tires? No. Wouldn't that be crazy?
That'd be nuts, yeah.
How's that any different than saying, well, I've blown it, now I might as well really blow it?
Right.
Well, listen, the moment you slit the other three tires, do you realize you delayed your journey? It's costing you more money, more time, because you don't have to buy one tire, now you have to buy four. See, the thing that I want to get across to people is that when they have a bad meal, it's perfectly okay. It's done no damage so long as you don't slit the other three tires. See, success can be measured by the simple fact that when someone has a bad meal, they get right back on track. Versus when they say, I've blown it, now I might as well really blow it. Where does that take them, Dan?
You backtrack.
Down a path of more blowing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But when you use new language skills and you say, if I just don't slit the other three tires, I'm doing great. Where does that take you?
That basically stops the damage, and you can pick up where you left off and keep going.
See, with that simple alteration of vocal skills, behavioral change is completely possible in an instant. By saying, if I just don't slit the other three tires, I'm doing great, I'm right back on track, whereas their old behavior and way of thinking would have taken them more off track, doing more damage.
Basically, with the first scenario, you lose control. When you slash all the tires, you feel like you lose control. Where if you just stop the damage where you start, you know, you can briefly stop what you started. Now you feel like you have control.
Actually, in both instances, you are the one in control. You chose to slit the other three tires, or you choose not to. It's all in the way you use language. Now, here's a question for you, Dan. I'm going to put you on the spot, but I'm going to tell you up front, there's no right or wrong answer. What's your definition of control? No right or wrong answer. What would it be?
I guess it would be the ability to contain. Well, wow, I don't know.
Interesting, isn't it? Interesting that the very thing you want the most of, you can't identify. Now, here's what I've come to learn. Anytime a client comes and sits in front of one of our nutritionists, they're saying two things without saying a word. And here's one of them. Keith, I need more control over this area of my life. Can you help me get more? Now, see, I had to make a real good in-depth study of what control means. Now, give me anything. What would you think it means?
The ability to manage something that you want.
Okay. Now, let me tell you my definition. I'll tell you up front. I've never, ever once looked it up in the dictionary. But what I do for a living beyond just being a nutritionist, you know, we call this show Beyond Diet, is that I study human eating behavior. I write about it. I study it. And our psychological background, we're not there to psychoanalyze people, but rather we're there to help them get through by using different thoughts, a tough time, or to change. So here's my definition of control. It's an alignment of your conscious thinking with your actions. It's all it is, Dan. It's nothing more, nothing less. So let me share it this way. If you state the desire that you want to be thin, fit, and trim, but you're unwilling to cook or carry food, and you don't want to exercise, then you're completely at odds with yourself. You're incongruent. And that creates an internal state of chaos in the brain. Man, I want to be losing weight, but I'm eating pizza, man. Why am I doing this to myself? So control happens when you align your conscious thoughts with your actions. That's what control is. See, it's not mystical. And it's not this, you know, big, I've lost it, I can't get it back kind of issue. If you feel as though you've lost control, is all you have to do is ask yourself the question, which of my actions are not lined up with my thinking, and what do I want to do about that? Well, I've not been going to the gym. Okay, there you have it. What do you want to do about that? I could start going to the gym 3 days a week, which is a lot better than none, right?
Yes.
Now, the second thing I want to ask you, and again, Dan, I put you on the spot, but everyone should know there's no right or wrong answer to this. Using language skills, good. So the second thing everybody says when they sit down in the chair in front of me is, Keith, I don't feel as though I have as much discipline over this area of my life. Can you help me get more? What would be your definition of discipline, Dan? Don't confuse it with control, but give us whatever you think it is.
To me, the definition of discipline is to do something regardless of how you feel. To do something even if you don't feel like doing it and you know you're determined to do it, you do it anyways. That to me is what the definition of discipline is.
Okay, that's really a good definition. Now, let me share you with you, as this is going to kind of sound a little strange. I would take credit for this definition, except I got it out of a fortune cookie, okay?
Okay.
Here's the definition of discipline. Very much like what you said, Dan. It's doing what's good for you even when you don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me share with you something. You say to me today, I'm going to get up and go to the gym in the morning. But when you wake up, it's cold and rainy outside, the bed's warm and cozy, and you don't want to go. You said you would go, but you decide not to, and you sleep in. How does that make you feel for the rest of the day?
Lousy.
Man, I could have gone. What's wrong with me? I wish I would have gone. Now, that's unempowering. That's not discipline. That weakens you. Now watch this. You say to me today, Keith, tomorrow morning I'm going to get up and go to the gym. But when you wake up, the bed's warm and cozy, it's cold and rainy outside, and you don't want to go. But you go anyway. How do you feel now?
You feel great.
When you're walking out of the gym, you feel great? Absolutely. For the rest of the day, you feel empowered, right?
Yes.
Okay. In Csikszentmihalyi's work, he wrote a book called The Optimal Experience of Happiness. It's known as Flow. Have you ever read it?
No.
Okay. Here's what he states, and it's rather interesting. I'm going to prove in that example what he just says. He said this, what humans think makes them happy makes them miserable, and what they think makes them miserable makes them happy. However, they don't know that, so they continue to engage in behaviors which will make them miserable. Now, you want an explanation?
Yeah, I do. If you can elaborate, that'd be great.
I will. The example we just used, that you told me you'd go to the gym, and when you woke up, the bed was warm and cozy, it was cold and rainy outside, and you didn't go. Do you understand that you stayed in bed because you thought it would make you happy, but it really made you miserable? That's you right. Thought it would make you happy to sleep in, but how did you feel after you didn't go?
Miserable.
Now watch this. When you wanted to sleep in, but you didn't, you got out of bed and you went to the gym, what you thought would make you miserable, getting out of bed, actually made you happy.
That's a lot of sense.
Well, yeah, it's the truth. See, here's the thing, Dan, that we're attempting to do through Beyond Diet. The truth is the truth, whether people want to accept it or not. And I've never been in control of anybody deciding what they want to do with my information. I'm only in control of giving them the truth. The media food chain is constantly lying to consumers on all levels of food labeling, the most recent diet books that are out, and you'll watch them shift, and it's almost like the wind. You know, so they were telling us years ago, don't eat any fat.
Right.
Well, that wasn't accurate, right? But if you'd come to me, you would have known the truth. Then they said, you know what? We're not eating enough fat. Eat more. And that didn't work. And then they said, hey, you know what? Carbs are bad. Cut them out. Well, that didn't work at all. That's gone. In fact, the Atkins company basically went bankrupt. They had to give their food away to the food bank because it was going under and going to go bad.
That's awful.
And now what they're telling you right now, Dan, the meat of food, eat more good fats. Do you understand that this media food chain is being driven by both the diet book industry and the food industry? It creates billion-dollar markets overnight. Oat bran reduces your levels of cholesterol. No, all fiber reduces your cholesterol, not just oat bran. But it spawned the big letters made with oat bran on everything, from cereal boxes to muffins. Forget the fact that they're high-fat, high-sugar muffins. If it had oat bran in it, it sold.
What's interesting, Keith, is the whole whole grain movement, if you will. I saw something that was really peculiar. I was at the supermarket the other day, and I saw whole grain donuts. It's unbelievable. It's
ridiculous. There's another lie. It's a manipulation. Let me share this with you. See, I did a big radio show on General Mills, and basically telling everybody that on all these boxes of processed cereals, which state in big letters, made with whole grains, I opened the boxes and I didn't find a whole grain in any of them. A whole grain should be a whole piece of wheat. It should be bulgur. It should be a bean. It should be a legume. It should be a whole grain kernel, right?
Right.
And that's not in there. Once you pulverize the whole grain, you've processed it. It lost its complexity, and now it's handled as a simple sugar. But here's what's interesting about the food industry. Notice that the food industry will put in gigantic bold letters that which is recently most popular. And they will never mention, and they don't want to tell you about the fact that this is a high sugar, low fiber, low protein cereal. But suddenly the words made with oat bran become the big selling point. And everyone neglects to see that there's no fiber, very little protein, and it's high in sugar. And it's a processed cereal. You can hear my dog. Yeah, that's my dog.
What kind of dog is it?
I have two. I have a black lab and a chocolate lab.
Nice.
That's my phone.
That's fine. That's what makes podcasting interesting. We're kind of running out of time. So let's wrap it up, Keith, to answer. So if I'm listening to the podcast, summing it up, if I want to lose weight and if I want to start taking the steps to getting there, to getting lean and getting that body that I want, what is it that I need to do this week?
First of all, number one and foremost is the fact that people tune in every week to this show. And the reason is because they're going to find here and only here they can get information that they're not going to find in the magazines, they're not going to see on TV, and it's the kind of real-world information that people can take and use and put to use right away. The first thing that I would ask anybody to do when they tune off of the podcast and they're not listening to Beyond Diet anymore, I would like them to begin thinking about never, ever, 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 in fact, this isn't allowed. Nobody is allowed to diet ever again. From this moment forward, I would ask that people start asking themselves the question, how do you see yourself living the rest of your life out as a healthy human being? I would identify the one thing that you think is creating a problem for your weight, and now your job when you leave this podcast before the next one is to get it in order and simply do better. The sole goal that anybody who listened today has is simply make better choices than you were making before you tuned in today.
So if you're eating out 3 times a week, if you cut it down to 2.
Or when you go out to eat, make a better bad choice. Okay. See, instead of eating so much red meat, order chicken. Instead of having it smothered in cream sauce, ask for the sauce on the side. Instead of putting sour cream, cheese, and bacon on your baked potato, try ketchup. It tastes just like French fries, believe it or not. Who on earth would eat a French fry if they couldn't put salt and ketchup on it, right? So the reality is there's better bad choices. And we have a dining out guide, by the way, which will be going online soon that we'll be able to give listeners when they click and sign up for it, okay?
Great, Keith. So what's the website where people can get this?
It's at eatingmanagement.com. It's like E-A-T-I-N-G, then the word management.com. And do you realize that when you go to our homepage and you see Dining Out with Keith Klein and you click it, we have the calorie and fat content of all the restaurants that are nationwide. Whether it's La Madeleine, whether it's Payway, whether it's P.F. Chang's, no matter where, you'll be able to click it and find a better choice than the one you were eating, one that's lower in calories and one that's lower in fat. That'd be a great place for everybody to start. And that's great. Eatingmanagement.com.
Now, what are we going to talk about next week, Keith?
We're going to continue the conversation about how to change the way you think about being healthy and fit, because what people have to come to the realization is that, as I said from the beginning, this has never been about your weight or your health. This is all about changing the way you think about your weight and your health, because when you change the way you think, you will then change the way you eat. And so what we're going to continue to focus in on is some of the common myths and what I call myth conceptions about food, the food industry, and eating right.
Okay, so join us next week, and we will continue on our mission with Beyond Diet Podcast.
Hey, thank you, Dan. And until next time, everybody, stay healthy, be fit, and we'll be here at the same bat station, same bat time next week.